Yeah, Quinn, I'm going to need you to go ahead and come in on Saturday. Thanks. We got that podcast I'm going to need you to finish on Saturday. Thanks, buddy. See you on Saturday.
Oh, man.
That's the Dakar Rally Daily Show, Saturday edition. It's rest day, and Climb Dakar Rally Daily Show is not taking the day off, are we, Quinn?
It's day without a race.
It's not a rest day anymore, is it? Day without race.
Yep.
We're here in the Cycle News studio. Today's show is presented by Rally Navigator. And I got a tip for everybody out there that wants to learn how to start racing rally or even looking at rally. You can download their mobile app for free. Just go on to the app store of your choice. Look for Rally Navigator Reader. Download it. They have some sample roadbooks in there. You can just pick it. You can scroll it. You can zoom in and then try to start figuring out what it means.
Yeah.
There's plenty of videos on their website that'll help you navigate it and explain it, but head to rallynavigator.com to learn. Go onto the App Store, download their free PDF viewing app. It's really cool. You can even use it like on your bicycle driving around. You can see how the odometer and the speed works and everything.
I mean, you can get on there. You can literally make a roadbook of your commute to work in the morning.
Yeah, and follow it on
your
app.
Phone and drive a roadbook on the way to work.
Yes,
and,
I think I highly recommend. That's a fantastic idea.
Perfect practice for the Dakar Rally.
It will give you some perspective of what they're going through, at least, and that's insane. When you get that sort of mental association with what they're doing all day, and then you see what they're actually doing, you're going to be really more impressed if you're a super fan, like the rest of us.
For sure, get on a Rally Navigator.
Yep, do it. The reason we're super fans is because these guys are, you know, pretty awesome and they do cool things. But unfortunately, we get some guys banged up and we had a couple big injuries this week, at the end of last week, I should say. Skyler, obviously out of the race after a big get off, big concussion. We talked to him in the hospital and then I ended up getting a hold of him last night and he sent me a couple messages. So a little update on Skyler's situation. He's flying home today. He'll be home Sunday. And we're going to talk to him a couple times this week. But he's in pretty good spirits considering his race is over. But he did take a big crash to the head and helmet. And, you know, he's being really careful about recovering and being safe. So wish him the best of luck again. It's good to hear from him. And then yesterday, Ross Branch, sounds like he had a big scary crash. There's a few highlights of his bike parked next to it and pile of parts that Andrew Short posted today. Ooh, that was a sketchy one. But we reported that he had a broken leg yesterday because that's what the information we received. But apparently he doesn't, which is fantastic news. And he's going to enter the race again. And we actually got a little clip from the Andrew Short Ross Branch team we're going to play right now. So here's Ross Branch giving us an update on his Monster Energy Yamaha effort.
Yesterday I had a really big crash, probably one of the biggest crashes of my career. But all in all, it was just some bleeding on the muscle, a really lucky escape. But I'm good. We're going to try and give it a go tomorrow and see how it goes.
He's one of the most positive people in the entire world. He's always smiling.
Yeah. The guy nonstop smiling. He sounds like nothing happened, really.
It's just bleeding on your muscle.
Yeah.
That sounds kind of serious.
You know, this is kind of part of the new rule this year. That the ASO and the FIM have implemented. So, you know, they made the Dakar part of the FIM World Rally Championship Series. So they're allowing riders who go out of the event to re-enter within 3 days of their exit with medical clearance. So it sounds like Ross got medical clearance to re-enter the race. So it'll be exciting to see him back and maybe he can help his team out. Kind of adds a little bit of a twist to the event. And, you know, maybe they can use him for some strategy.
Also, maybe he can get a stage win like Danilo Petrucci did.
Right.
After he re-entered the race. Speaking of Petrucci, we have Rennie Skagebrook, our Cycle News in-house road test editor. He's got a lot of MotoGP knowledge. He has a lot of knowledge about the history of Petrucci's coming up through the MotoGP ranks. And Rennie's also an Australian, so he's got a lot of interest in Dakar Rally. He's a great guy to talk to. We got a conversation with him we're going to come up with a little bit later. But right now, I think we kind of wanted to cover some things that we don't have time to talk about that much during every day's race to race to race. Also coming up, we got some Q&As that we're going to give out there for you guys. But right now, let's get into the original by Moltul class. So traditionally called the Malle Moto. This is independent racers that are racing in the spirit of the original Dakar adventure, which is no support.
Yep.
Right.
So yeah, they call it the original, or, you know, the Malimoto marathon class, whatever yeah, it may be called. It's got a lot of names over the years, but in the beginning, when Dakar was in Africa, generally the organization would transport a metal airplane box, which is, I don't know,
it's like a meter long.
Yeah. 3 feet by 2 feet.
By 1 foot deep.
Yeah. And whatever you could put in there, spare parts, you know, any personal items, riding gear.
Snacks,
whatever. That's what you got to take to the rally.
The whole distance of the rally.
Yep. And, you know, there were assistance trucks, but it was kind of unsure if they were going to show up because the assistance trucks were part of the race. So sometimes they wouldn't show up till a day or two later.
Yeah, you need to get there, hope that the airplane landed at the bivouac or close to the bivouac, and all your stuff got dropped off in the dirt, including your box and your tent.
Yep.
And then you're like, whoop, now I got to work on my bike, lube my chain, replace some parts that might have broke that day. But all that has to be in your box, or you have to source it from one of these random service trucks that might be there.
Yeah. So the original by Motul now is a class that basically gives the guys an airplane box. Whatever they can fit in there is what they can take. They'll transport a spare set of wheels for them. And then Motul provides whatever lubricants they need. And they have their own little small bivouac where they set their tents up. They have a little service area where they can work on the bikes.
Yep.
But they keep those guys isolated. So no outside assistance. They're basically on their own. So no one can touch their bike. It's, you know, it's the true spirit of the Dakar.
And it's the adventure.
They're sleeping in a tent. They're, you know, surviving.
So cool. And they're also hauling ass.
Yeah, I mean, some of the like, top guys are really good riders. And
yeah, they're racing. You know,
they're inside. The leader of the Malimoto class right now is inside the top 30 overall.
Yeah, so he's racing on the same course. And, you know, he's crushing it out there. We're going to get some more insight into that. But right now, I got a special guest calling in, Jimmy Lewis.
Uh-oh.
So hold tight.
Okay, let's see if we can get Jimmy on here.
Jimmy Lewis, are you there?
I'm here.
Nice. You're in civilization. You crawled out of the hole in the desert.
Where is here?
Pahrump, Nevada.
All right.
Valley of the Dirt People.
Where?
Valley of the Dirt People.
All right.
I'm in the middle of a tile job.
Oh, you're working. You're working on the Jimmy Lewis bivouac.
Compound, we call it.
Nice. Well,
so
you're live.
People to shower and shave and stuff in the comfort.
You're getting soft out there in Nevada. You got to get these guys toughened up. Oh, by the way, you're live. We're recording all of this right now.
Oh, you're doing a show.
Yeah, you're on
about this.
You're on the show. You are the show today.
Oh, I mean, isn't it rest day? Can't you get everybody else? Are they all busy doing real media?
They don't want to talk to you. They are busy doing real media jobs for sure.
Glad you got a hold of a second rate guy trying to find a tool.
You're literally the last person we tried to call, and you're the only one that was dumb enough to answer.
Okay.
Well,
so how can I help you boys today?
Thanks. Thanks. Have you been following the race at all? Have you been geeking out about it?
Of course. I don't know about geeking out. I always feel like my work's done once they leave here.
Mm-hmm.
Cause you know, it's all the practice and the training.
Yeah.
And then it's what happens is sort of what happens, but yeah, you know, I follow it. I try, you know, to pay attention to see how things are changing, you know, with the way that the race winds up and is run. And most of that I really get from the guys when they come back, you know, they tell me specifically, but I also kind of watch it because, you know, you always get a bias from each of them when they kind of explain their thing. And luckily I've worked with, you know, two of the best guys, and then they between the two of them, I get a pretty good picture.
You can decipher their marketing spin.
Yeah, it's not marketing spin. It's just how they see it. But yeah, something like this.
Okay, cool. Well, how do you think it's shaken out for the racers on the ground this year?
I'm really disappointed, and not just because my guys aren't doing all that well. It's because I'm hearing these words that I hate. I just guess, and I got lucky, and these are things that I learned in my racing, if you're going to depend on guessing or luck, I guess I'm going to jump the triple jump, or I guess I'll go this way, or I was just going and I got lucky. And you'll hear people, say that there's a certain amount of luck involved in any type of motorsports, especially, but these guys they're top athletes. They all train, they're all fast, they all practice navigation, and to a high level. And when the organization somehow makes the map look tricky enough where you have to guess, you can't train to this, because especially on the day one, and day one, I went over and looked at that a bunch of times and talked to a lot of people and listened to all the different interviews and the top guys that got there early. And then for the next, it was probably the next 7 or 8 riders, you can watch on the tracker and kind of vaguely see what they do. The tracker isn't quick enough to see exactly what they do, but to watch those guys go, and they all did, quote, the right thing. Because when you come to a note that's like tricky, and then there's a series of things that you do, and you practice this. Yeah. You do the note, and all of a sudden it's not working. And then when we started getting video images, okay, you see where the tracks went. And I don't know if that was opening car tracks or a local
truck
vehicle that went through there. And I understand that it was wet, and for sure the wet changes. But they're supposed to run an opening car across these road books. And if you look at some of the forms on ADV Rider and stuff, there's guys that have gone out and found posts from the opening car drivers, and they took pictures of their equipment, and they took pictures of their notepad. It's crazy how much information travels around, and whether it's accurate or not. I would say the interpretations of what these guys are saying just go out the window, because they don't know. They're just firing off behind the keyboard. Some of them are good, but they're able to collect information.
Yeah.
And then, but to watch the top guys all go, and they all did like exactly what they should have done, it literally, if it took someone like Ricky Brabec an hour to figure out the note, and I know exactly what Ricky did, and Ricky did everything he possibly could have, and the way he finally verified, in other words, got to the next waypoint, the way he did that was all kind of what you would do. But in that hour, there's five other guys that are really good, that are collectively kind of doing their own thing. They're all watching each other, but they're kind of doing their own thing. And for you to be lucky enough to just happen to ride through right about the time some of the guys, we'll call it, figured it out. Mm-hmm. But trust me, they were taking a really wild guess in order to do what they did to get to the waypoint when they did, kind of a thing.
Yeah.
At that point, they tried option one, option two, option, and they were on option three, which is like, well, maybe this number is, maybe there's a typo. At this point, we're going with a fully bad note.
Yeah.
And I don't know.
And so, you got to ride 10 kilometers to figure it out.
11 actually, but yeah, same thing. Six before you even get a taste in your mouth that you've done the wrong thing.
Yeah.
So that's 12 kilometers back and forth. If you just go back in that, cause that note didn't kind of, magically appear. Mm-hmm. So this, and then it's happened multiple times. And I don't know if this is something that they're going to continue to do, but a map book has to be, solvable. And if you had one guy out there that was just by himself and not able to see that, so what you do is if something goes wrong and, it's not working, you have to go, you try all these things and you have to go back to where that note is, where the problem is. And if you go back there and there's other guys, nobody's figured it out.
Yeah.
But if you go back there and there's still guys, or you start seeing tracks going other, especially in the wet, that's kind of the other thing that changed a lot of the dynamics, in my opinion, is the ability to make it real easy to follow tracks. But you get back there, and if it was just one guy out there, they never would have been able to figure out the note. Mm-hmm. It would have taken all day, 6 hours, and at that point you're looking for a lost watch in the sand.
Yeah.
That's 11 kilometers away, and you have to, there's a technique for this, but I sure as hell wouldn't want to guess how to to guess how to do it.
Not in the first day of the Dakar rally, anyway.
No.
Yeah,
no. It's a main contender. And so that's been kind of a shame. I mean, I wish that they're playing with this kind of double-edged sword where they're using the navigation to slow everything down, and they're making the navigation, you know, what they're calling tricky, but they're going overboard so that even if they make the navigation really tricky, you can't, you know, you're going to get this seesaw effect that we're starting to see, you know, and this is the second year of it, because you just know it's a penalty to open. And so now it becomes a more of a game of chess, kind of the strategy of how can I stay in contention without losing too much time?
How do I win without winning a stage?
And I think the other thing that's happening, and when you see, you know, what I always say, rookie riders going out and winning stages, it's not because they're and I'm not taking anything away from their riding skill and all this other stuff.
Yeah, right.
I'm not at all. When you see rookie riders winning stages amongst the guys that have been doing it forever, it's not because they're incredibly faster in it. It's because everybody else is doing something else, which is either strategy, you know, going slow, and or having to navigate to the point where if you don't have a navigate, you know, it changes. And it's real simple when you start watching the top guys, you know, you can tell who's really the cream of the crop when they start in front and open with a speed that keeps them in front. Mm-hmm. When you see someone mistakenly, you know, end up in first, and I mean, and I don't want to say mistakenly, and that they, you know, everybody wants to win the stage, you end up in first and end up back in, you know, out of the top 20 the next day, that's usually a tale of your navigation prowess.
Mm-hmm. So the navigation is really kind of blurring that line of being productive to make close racing to being problematic and just creating a bigger problem, you think?
Yeah. I don't know if I necessarily know the answer. I mean, it seems like they're bringing back kind of like longer stages. Mm-hmm. And I guess, you know, making it tricky to slow it down is okay. But when everybody kind of races from the back, I don't know if it's to the point where we need to kind of do something with the starting to change the starting order. I'm a fan of the mass start, you know, the starting everybody in a row. Then you, at least, you know, you get those pictures of a bunch of guys kind of riding together and it's awesome. But I tell you, know, some of the riders really liked it. I loved it. I don't know. I'm coming from a desert racing background. I liked it because then the first guy to the finish line wins.
Yeah.
And you still have to navigate, and then you can play your cards. Then it becomes a little bit more like Tour de France, which ASO should be very familiar with.
Right.
you end up with this kind of like peloton and breakaway things, which
could work.
Is good, but yeah, I don't know.
From the images I've seen of the road book and stuff is that they're adding so much information to the note that it's, if you were to basically read and analyze every piece of information that they're giving you, then it's going to slow you way down. And probably a lot of guys are just looking at the tulip and going off the arrow and maybe confirming a little bit, but
yeah. Yeah, and we practice this. This is something that we saw this coming, and you know, and here. So there's two big things. No, you know, map book is delivered in the morning, so you don't get to really study it.
Right.
That's the first, you know, caveat, and then the second one is these really complicated, you know, we'll call them double and triple notes, and most of the information is in the third box, and it requires reading. And if you are reading your road book, you are not racing.
Right.
Or you're taking very, very big chances. And so now you're starting to hear the guys that are crashing saying, well, I was looking at my road book and blammo.
Yeah, that's what someone said.
That's not very safe. And all these things the organization is doing, you know, when they start talking about speed limits and restrictor plates and last year the tire rule and all the things that they're trying, it's quote for safety. And So obviously that isn't, and I as a guy who really likes the navigation and that's what we train and teach, like I think, you know, that having difficult navigation is a good thing, but when it's causing these kind of things, and we trained and practiced to this, and it does slow it down. There's no doubt about it. But like we said, this whole thing is next level, and not next level in a good way.
Yeah, it's just stopping the race more than slowing it down. Just for some of the guys, though, unfortunately, it's right out of the gate, and then they got into a hole that is just insurmountable to get out of at this moment.
Yeah, and you know, like I said, conditions, you know, the weather conditions, the wet conditions, and the ground really conditions made that played into it. And but they, you know, so the only way I can, you know, just for the layperson, we've got all this technical stuff that, you know, you think about it. What they've done is they've made a race between scavenger hunts, and so you're gonna haul ass, and you're gonna get someplace. You're gonna have a scavenger hunt. And you got to go find something that maybe may or may not be there. And they're doing this, you know, whether it's, you know, one time a day or three or four times a day. And here the real sad part is if you did train all year and practice and do this, and then all of a sudden this is the new game, and I can be beaten by someone who is just getting lucky in the scavenger hunt portion. Mm-hmm. That's frustrating. And yeah,
for sure.
Yep. Frustrating race for a lot of people, I think. There are some people that are getting through it still. Like, you know, the guys at the top of the leaderboard, they're either just going faster, and their side of that swing has been timed right, so they get to these tricky points when somebody's already solved it, or they've just, you know, maybe adapted and read it better, or how does that work?
It all started on day one with kind of a luck of positioning. Yeah. Just happened to be where you came through and the timing of all that, and then when you sort of, you know, got yourself back on track. And so I think that sort of set the stage. And then from that point, I think a certain group of riders sort of went on to managing. They tried to kind of keep their position in, you know, so that they won't have a big deficit when this happens again. And it did, and it has happened a couple other times where you're seeing, you know, like there's no hour long chunks that I've seen, but I've seen a couple 20 and 30 minute chunks, which is more normal. The hour one was a little outrageous.
Yeah.
But, so, you know, and when you have, I mean, I guarantee that in that group of riders, there's 20 semi guys that could easily be on the podium.
Yeah.
Like, definitely. You know, you guys picking every day, picking, guessing every day. Well, I mean, yeah, exactly. you're guessing just like some of the navigation.
We're trying and guessing.
Yeah. Yeah. So no, you've had some really good insight, and then all the reasoning behind some of the picks and stuff has been solid. And there's, like I said, there's some really impressive rides going on, and there's other stuff that, like, okay, well, yeah, you know, and we didn't really see chaos start till day four.
Yeah, which a couple days ago. I think
in my days it was always day three, and I it's just, I think there's just so much more information available and to the teams, and how they, you know, how they can kind of plan and strategize. And I've seen some of this, you know, firsthand, some of the strategies that go into play, and it's way beyond what, I mean, back in our days, it's kind of just go, and there's a little bit of team orders, you know, hey, this guy's faster, we're kind of all working for him, sort of a deal.
Mm-hmm. Who do you think's the best positioned for the second half of the race?
Right now, anybody who's up in that 15-minute window.
Yeah, so the top six guys are.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's anybody who's up there that you know, manages that comes across the right time the next time this you know, navigation snafu takes place. And if it does, I mean, the organization may have realized, it's like, oh, you know. I've heard that there's multiple guys, you know, making the road book. So it's not necessarily the same road book guy every day.
Right. They're alternating through or.
I've heard this. So one day it may be one, and they may have identified, you know, I'm sure they've looked into it, and they may have identified places, and they may have gone back and
updated the road book,
Cleaned it up a little bit, but you just never know. You know, you don't know. This is a, I mean, maybe if you're on a French team, you might know.
Well, the Yamaha guys have got it figured out.
Yeah, Yamaha guys.
Yeah, we're seeing it. Yeah, my good buddy Pablo on the quad is suffering from a from an organization decision that was very French.
Oh, geez. Sorry,
so Pablo. he had a pretty good lead, and then the way that they decided when they cut the stage, he lost a lot of time, and then he came back, and so it wasn't that bad. But where they decided to neutralize the stage really cost him. I mean, they could have they really it was one of those things, like they were on course and they could have chose almost any spots where they would neutralize it.
And just picked it.
Yeah, French guy got a really big advantage based on where they decided.
What do you think about that that shortening of the stage or neutralization of the stage yesterday? What's your take on that?
I'm old school, you know. If the course is the course, if you take off and complete the course. And didn't Ricky and Toby get to ride an extra 100 kilometers of that crap?
Yeah.
They rode a bit. I don't know if it was a full 100 kilometers, but it was quite a ways.
Yeah, Mason was saying that they took off after the refueling and went out and were navigating, and he's like, the bad course was behind us. We already went through all the bad stuff looking forward because they had their own little section.
Yeah, evidently it was like a key loop, you know, a keyhole. They came back, so they went on the out and back kind of stuff, which, you know, I think they've done this before, and they've been told that the tracks are way too torn up, and they do this a lot in Morocco. And it's just different times. I mean, back, you know, and when I used to race, you couldn't do this because you were always moving.
You were trying to
get to the next point and now they're and it's for logistics and costs and setting up things for rest day. But those guys are riding so fast and they're pushing so hard. It's like National Hare and Hound speed for, you know, the top guy, easily, but faster because the train's more conducive, but without markings. And I saw another interesting comment. Somebody said that they should take out all the dangers altogether. And I hate to say it, but a lot of the road books that we train on, we don't pre-run them. The only certain ones that we pre-run and we verify beforehand. But our road books a lot of times don't have dangers. So you have to read the terrain, and then them expecting every single danger to be marked, which is what they do. Mm-hmm. Maybe that would slow them down. But you want to take catastrophic, you know, you all of a sudden, you know, you're going to have a catastrophic thing where it's like, it was just perfectly flat except for that one ditch.
Yeah.
That nobody saw. And evidently that's what it was that caused when the top guys go down, you know, when the first two guys that are on course go down
so quickly.
Yeah. That's something that, like I said, should have been on the road book, and they expect this to be on the road book, but it wasn't.
Their point was like, hey, the road book doesn't represent the race course anymore. So the thing we have to guide us through this race is kind of useless at this point because we're riding basically a National Hare and Hound course. But
I think the guys now, you know, some of the guys know that if they make enough noise and they cry loud enough that they're going to get attention and, you know, possibly get the stage thrown out and it seemed to kind of work for them. I think in the old days, you didn't have a voice. There was no cell service. They weren't going to call, you know, the race director and get him to stop the stage in the middle of it. You just had to finish it.
Kind of like the one a few days earlier, or I guess the day earlier, where they shortened it also because they were spread thin on medical. And this has happened. I've been in races where all of a sudden the helicopters were all busy, the doctors and the medics were all busy, and they were spread out over a long course. And at a refueling, they'd either stop you and say, okay, we're going to wait an hour, you know, instead of 15 minutes, now it's an hour or 2 hours to see if we can get this thing kind of sorted. Or they would, you know, like I said, then at that point, just neutralize it. So on the side of safety, you can't complain. You can't complain this. But if we get to this point where it's like all of a sudden a top rider raises his hand and goes, I think this is too scary.
Maybe you don't belong there.
Yeah. And the course not matching the road book, well, that's the same as these quote tricky notes.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just you don't get hurt when you're wandering around out in the desert trying to find a waypoint.
No shortage of excitement and surprises at this race still. It's always unpredictable. It's always throwing wrenches into people's plans, and you know, ugh, just it, like Ricky said really well in the beginning of it, was like keeping your head straight and your head like fresh is almost as more important than keeping your body fresh and your bike fresh. It's like you can't get into that snowball effect, he called it, of getting down in the dumps about a mistake you made or something that doesn't make sense. You kind of just leave it in the past and go forward, and that's just so hard this year.
Yeah, that and when I, you know, like I said, when I listen to these rider interviews that you guys are doing in other places, I'm hearing they, I can read a little bit between the lines, yeah. and I can see, you know, I can see how important that is, but then again, that just I don't think you're getting, you know, they're riding for their team and they're trying to keep their, I mean, mostly at this point, a lot of them are just trying to keep their head up, you know, they're yeah. trying to stay, they're trying to stay positive and you know, yeah, I'm here, you know, I'm here, I'm full gas and everything like that. But you're like,
yeah, you can hear it in their voice. You
yeah,
know,
the wind.
Yeah, there's
the wind is out of the sail.
And you can see it in the results.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The time, the clock yeah. doesn't lie.
No. And like I said, and I mean, there's something to be said for some of this, you know, what they're doing with the World Rally points and that, you know, letting riders back in the race is kind of different, but it, you know, the only thing about rally is it's going to change or be different.
Right.
It's so not a,
you're not doing yeah, laps out there.
Yeah. You're trying to, you know, they're trying to keep it evolving. And then I think the best riders are able to adapt and go with it, but it's still kind of the core base. It's got to be a really fast motorcycle rider and you got to know how to navigate.
Yeah. And you got to be tough as shit.
That just comes with the territory.
I think so. Awesome. Well, thanks, Jimmy, from your home compound yeah. in Pahrump, Nevada. You can find Jimmy at, where did we find you? Jimmy Lewis Offroad.
JimmyLewisOffroad.com. Hey, if right. people are interested, and I do have our basic rally navigation course coming up on February 11th.
Awesome.
The Friday in a little while.
That's right around my birthday. You could get me one of those entries for my birthday present.
It's going to fill up. It's gonna fill up, Jesse. So I don't know if you'll be able to make it.
That was harsh. So yeah, hit up Jimmy Lewis Off Road. Enter a rally navigation school. You can also just like if you're self aware enough to know you need help riding a motorcycle, go to one of his classes, and you will get incredibly better at riding a motorcycle with the basic instruction.
We teach that too.
Yeah, I definitely recommend
that first.
Yeah, do that
then,
first.
Then you can worry about starting to navigate. So I know we've seen this the other way around where guys want to learn to navigate before they learn to ride the motorcycle. Yeah. And so go to Jimmy and get your skills up first.
You can do it in a car. We do it with the car driver navigation yeah. teams and stuff like that. It's all the same. It doesn't matter what right. vehicle you're in. The navigation is like this. But and with the difference between the riding school and navigation school, we do them 100% separate because they're 100% separate things. They're yeah, different, definitely. You know. And like I get asked all the time. It's like, yeah, I'd like to come out and do a sand dune navigation class with you. I'm like, oh. Okay, so what's the problem? Are we having a problem riding the sand, or are we having a problem navigating?
Yeah.
And they're like, well, you know, like when you do them both. I go,
those are two different classes.
I usually kind of go to, well, so you're having a problem riding in the sand, and then you forget how to navigate, right? Or it's like, well, no, I just don't understand how it works in the sand. Well, it's real easy. You go in the sand, you can pretty much go anywhere you want. So navigation becomes so much easier. Yeah, and they're like, funny. What?
Why am I having such a hard time?
it's interesting, but I, you know, like I say, I really kind of enjoy seeing people improve and teach them, and it's good time. So all yeah, right. Thanks, one of these days, Jesse.
Yeah, one of these days I'll get back out there. You'll invite me to go on a trail ride someday again.
Those are fun.
Yeah, someday. Someday we'll hang out again. Until then,
okay.
Thanks, buddy. Appreciate
right, Jimmy,
it.
Okay,
take
you.
Care. I've been enjoying the show, and you know, I just wanted to let you know I wear climb gear every day.
Yeah, dude.
I exclusively use Rally Navigator now.
Nice.
I do that.
You are
just a team player.
You're a poster boy for the Climb Dakar Rally Daily Show presented by Rally Navigator today.
Yeah, cool. Well, anyways, have a great day, and we'll I'm back to the tile saw.
Okay, get back to tile. Bye.
Okay, see ya.
Great chat with Jimmy. Guy's got a bunch of stuff going on in his head about rally this year, I bet.
Oh, yeah. You know, he's just tormented out there.
Oh, he's so mad.
Watching this.
watching it unfold.
Watching his boys struggle on day one. That's, I think that was a hard one for him to swallow for sure. But
yeah,
like you said, it's, you know, it's unfortunately there's that gamma chance, you know, sometimes rolling the dice and you can't train for that.
No, you can't train for that. You can go to Jimmy and train.
Yep.
That's for sure. I've instructed on some of his classes before. They're really good. All right, let's get back into this Malemoto, original by Motul. We were just talking the leader of that race. He's in like the top 30 overall in the general standings. Let's get that pulled up here. But
I can't even say the guy's name. So
Runas Galaz Ninkas from the Orion Dakar team from Lithuania.
Yeah.
He's been riding for 21 hours and 46 minutes.
Yeah, and you look at the times, and he's only an hour and a half behind Sam Sunderland, the leader. So when you think about it, over 20 hours.
That sounds like being an hour behind somebody sounds like a long time. But in 20 hours, like.
I guarantee you the top 10 will probably be an hour behind by the end of this rally.
Yeah, this is an impressive run when you have zero of the comforts of any of the top riders. You don't have a motorhome. You shower in like a mobile shower unit somewhere on site at the bivouac, if you get one, right? You go into a mess hall tent and grab some food, whatever it is there.
That bag sounds of snacks. Basically like my Dakar experience, except that I had a mechanic to work on the bike for me.
Yeah, so which is another luxury these guys don't have. They they do get, like we said, oil supplies by Motul. They got all their chain lubes. They got all the chemicals and stuff they need to take care of their bikes supplied by them. Everything else is on them.
Yeah.
Pretty cool race.
It's the real deal. And I think it's a cool class. It would be nice to see these guys get a little more attention
We're going to work on getting on the phone with current racers. Cause there's a bunch of those out there that would probably love to talk if they have time. So they're working on their bike. And there's a lot of past racers that have done this a few times, you know, Lyndon Poskett's done it a couple times. I know him pretty well. Maybe call him we got a couple of you have sent us some messages about some guys that have done it and won it and are interested in chatting with us. So we'll try to get on that program in the second week if we have time. That's the big theme is time, isn't it, Quinn?
Yeah.
This race is built on time.
It is. This is, this is kind of us trying to get to everything that we haven't been able to get to during the week because we're pretty busy with, you know, getting everything
busted out for every show
and figuring everything out and talking to
decipher stuff quickly, which is a good segue into our Q&A session.
Yep.
We got some Q&As in on our Instagram page, which is something like Dakar_rally_daily.
Yep.
It's the easiest way to find it. And we asked you guys to send up some questions. We've been getting them all week, but we got a big load of questions in yesterday. And I'm going to run through some rapid fire questions for Quinn.
All right, here we go.
The first one's a bit of a controversial topic and one that kind of pisses me off. Questions about trucks and cars overtaking motorcycles in the race. What's the standard like etiquette there? And what's up with the dude that's running over bikes? Because we've seen this happen before. And one of our good friends in the motorcycle industry, Ludo Bernard, who owns, 100%, he had a run-in with this guy back in the day when he was racing rally. Mm-hmm. So this is a French guy, I believe, or Spanish, South African. I don't know where this guy's from. Yep. He's not doing his home country proud by running into people. No. But there's video footage of him actually hitting a guy, knocking him over, really slow speed, but still knocking a guy over with a truck, and then kind of running over like the side of his bike. And apparently he's been running around doing this for years. But what's the normal etiquette that normal people would do? Truck bike interaction.
How does it work? This is always dangerous when you have the trucks and the bikes on the same course, and especially when the faster trucks and cars start catching up to the slower motorcycles, and motorcycles are struggling. They're having a hard time in a tricky spot, whatever. But the ASO has a thing called the Sentinel system, and it's basically a pass alert system. So when the cars are catching a bike, the co-driver pushes a button and it sends off a buzzer on the bike. Then the bike guy is supposed to, hears the buzzer and is supposed to pull off and get out of the way.
Yeah, it's like a warning system. Somebody's coming up behind you. It's like a really loud horn that is coming through your bike's dash panel.
It for sure it's not 100% because, okay, the closing speed sometimes is so high that by the time it, I think it's 300 meters or something is the range. And by the time the guy hits the button, the car's already past the bike. You know, it's tough to get that, you know, working properly. I mean, we've seen 10 times more scary things happen in Baja with the trophy trucks. They're so much faster and so much more power, and the bumps are so much bigger, closing in on the slower bikes. And they've put in a similar pass alert system in Baja racing to help. And I think it's helped a bit to kind of warn the bikes that a faster vehicle is closing on them.
Mm-hmm.
But the, you know, the thing with Jeanil de Villiers is controversial for sure. And the case where there was the video of him actually kind of bumping into the back of the bike, it's a tight spot and he wasn't going super fast. I don't know exactly what was going through his head at that time, whether he was trying to keep his momentum or he was hung up or didn't quite see the guy, thought he could get around him.
Yeah.
But anyway, he hit the guy, knocked him over. Then the guy kind of crawled out of the way and sort of waved him on.
Yeah.
You know, so de Villiers took off, kind of ran over the side of his bike and split. Didn't look good on him for sure. He's a South African racer. He's been around for, I mean, I want to say this is like over 30 Dakars or something crazy. He's one of the most experienced guys. And I don't know, maybe he's just a grumpy old man who, you know, doesn't want people in his way, but,
he's got no patience.
And then I think there was another, incident where he actually came over the top of a dune and there was a motorcycle down on the other side and ran directly over the guy's bike.
Yeah.
And caused quite a bit of damage to the guy's bike, did a circle around, saw that the guy was standing up, and then just took off. I think he got a pretty big penalty for that one. I think it was only 5 or so minutes for the first guy, and then I think 5 hours or something for the second guy.
So they're slapping him on the wrist with some time penalties, but clearly he's not.
Yeah,
and he's not. I think he's not carrying on the Dakar racing spirit out there by.
No,
looking out for your fellow guy. It used to be you relied on the other racers to maybe offer you assistance because there wasn't a service truck coming for a long time.
Right.
You know, and you're going point to point out in the middle of the desert in Africa and you need the people coming up behind you to, you know, give you water or a tow or something like that. So,
I mean, that's the spirit of the Dakar, the race, but then, you know, you have these big money, high speed truck teams that are in the race for the overall lead.
Yeah.
And they're going flat out. And then you have these slower bikes that are just barely hanging on by the skin of their teeth just to stay in the race.
And they're coming into each other.
They're struggling in the stages, in the sand. And so it, anytime you have the top level of something mixed up with the very bottom level of a sport, then there's going to be problems.
There's going to be some conflict or at least some speed discrepancies that are going to cause inner actions, which may or may not be good for anybody. All right. Well, that clears up the Sentinel system. Thanks for that. Next question. This one we get a lot is how does somebody get into rally that's never done it before? And I think we talked with Jimmy about that and talked before the break with Jimmy about that. You know, get a roadbook reader, build a roadbook, put it in your car, put it on your bicycle, put it, you know, in your golf cart, whatever you got to do in your side-by-side if you have one of those, and just build a route, learn how to look at it at least.
For sure. I think
that's it.
The very basics of it is just kind of get a simple roadbook reader. You can use an iPad. You can use something like that.
Drop the Rally Navigator app on it.
Yeah, get a little practice navigating. Maybe get a couple of buddies to make roadbooks for each other. And then there's some North American rallies here that are the Sonora Rally, which is in Sonora, Mexico, is a great rally. It's multiple day rally in the sand dunes down there. Jimmy Lewis has a good school for training and things like that.
Yeah, pay attention to your local networks of riders. ADV Rider has people that post, hey, I'm doing a fun event here. If you want to do some rally navigation, yada, yada. Baja Rally, still happening on the Baja Peninsula, is another event you can enter. Small bikes, big bikes, side-by-sides. I think they have a side-by-side class. There are more and more of these opportunities to get there and experience it. I think the more people that are learning about it, a number one goal of our show, get people into it. There's going to be more, but you can do it yourself. You can start, quote unquote, a rally by getting Rally Navigator software, building a route through even your local trails on single track.
Yeah, and you can do it with two buddies on a weekend.
Having your buddies follow you and just be like, hey, we're not going to go by speed, but I want to see if you can get through this and find me at the end, you know, sort of that old hare and hound sort of thing. So that's our tips for doing it. Definitely try it. Yep. Definitely do it. We talked to Kendall yesterday, and he's the chef, right, of the Honda rig with Ricky and Nacho. How do most of the other competitors eat during the race? And this would be probably your experience too when you were there.
Yeah. So the organization, the ASO, sets up a massive mess tent, basically. Yeah,
catering tent. Bivouac
tent. And they have, I think they feed 3,000 people a day or something crazy between the organization and all the
team members
and stuff like that. Yeah, and so
media that's there probably.
There's a huge mess tent. They have breakfast, lunch, or they have breakfast and dinner. There's always like pasta or something there normally. And then they have these lunch bags that the riders or drivers can pick up in the morning and take with them. And it usually has like a can of like some weird canned meat and some crackers and maybe an apple in there. And
yeah,
not, some basic not snacks. Very good, but it'll get you by. And then of course the top teams have cooks and things like that to feed the riders a little bit better nutrition than just say the soup from the bivouac.
Yeah. Tent. But if you're there and you're racing, there's going to be food there provided by your entry fee. You don't have to go to a grocery store and grab your own food or find a restaurant.
And sometimes on the liaisons, you know, there'll be regular gas stations that you'll stop at and you can buy a candy bar, you can buy a snack. You see pictures of guys driving through McDonald's in their race car. So there's McDonald's in Saudi Arabia. You can go and eat McDonald's if you want. If you're on a liaison, it's not time section, then you're free to eat whatever you want as long as you make it back by your set time.
Hit a Starbucks. Get a caffeine fix out there.
That's right.
All right. Next question. Do all the rally, since the motorcycle is split into classes now from Rally 2, Rally MotoGP, or Rally GP, Mally Moto, do they all do the same course every day? Most of the motorcycles.
Yeah, so everything's on the same course. They're all scored in the overall classification. So the general classification covers all the classes. And then they'll have results for the Rally 2 and Mally Moto separately. And each one of those guys will get a trophy for winning their class or a prize, whatever that may be.
But there's not like a take a right here if you're in Mally Moto class or take a left here if you're in the Rally GP class. It's all the same course.
Yeah, the only one that does a separate course is the Dakar Classic, which is like the vintage cars that are racing. And so they'll do a separate course. They use some of the same stuff, but sometimes they're a day or so ahead.
Yeah,
occasionally they'll have a different course for the trucks, like maybe a section where the trucks won't fit or something. So they'll run a little different thing there. But
Those trucks. All right, cool. All right, this is a good question for me. What time do episodes go live every day?
That's a good one. What time do they go live, Jesse? What's our daily schedule?
Here's our little work process. I'm in the studio here at about 5:15 in the morning every day, downloading results. We're trying to get a hold of riders for quotes or team members for quotes or interviews. And we record anywhere from like 5:30, 6 o'clock, as long as it takes to get the show done. So California time, hopefully by 8 a.m., we're kind of wrapped up with recording and all of that stuff goes. And then it goes into the production cycle. We run it through a couple systems to make sure it all sounds good. We cut and edit, interviews in place because sometimes we get the interview first thing in the morning. Sometimes we get it at the end. Yesterday, we got a quote from Mason after the show was done that we had to record again and put back in. So there's a lot of cut and pasting going on in the audio file to try to get it dialed in. My goal, quote unquote, 9 o'clock in the morning, California time. That's when I want to hit the publish button. But it's been a little later than that this year because the show's gotten bigger. It's taken a little longer. So you can expect it by midday most of the time, I think is a safe bet.
We try to wrap up now that I'm recovered from COVID. I have to be back at work at 8 a.m.
we have real jobs, and
my office is about 15 minutes from Cycle News Studio. So,
he's trying to get out of here by 7:45.
Get out of here by 7:45. Get to work by 8.
Yeah,
Jesse starts cranking away on the editing. And
don't tell my bosses that I'm trying to get this done by 9. I tell them 8. Just kidding. They don't care. Expect it by 9, but don't be disappointed if it's noon. That's the end result there.
Yeah. I would say by noon, you're going to have something.
You're going to be loving life by noon. Here's a good one that I have a little experience helping people with. How do riders stay warm during liaisons? You can see these guys, they're dressed up in like snowmobile suits or, you know, parkas and that kind of stuff. And I worked at Climb back in the day when Jonah Street was racing, and we used to ship him actual insulated snowmobile gear for the rally. And they put on these big, you know, pants, bibs, gloves, jackets on top of their riding kit, and they just cruise down the road and you're still pretty cold. It's not a comfortable place. Today, a lot of people have heated gear. There's heated gloves on the market. They're battery operated. They're very easy throw on and off. But really you're trying to cut the wind. Number one, insulation is secondary almost to just chopping that wind from sinking through your body. So you'll see the big mitts on the handlebars to cover up their grips and stuff like that, which is a good follow-up question. Somebody else asked, why aren't there grip heaters on the bikes? And I think that probably goes back to complications, electronics. You don't want to introduce another system that can fail plugging into the system.
I mean,
probably.
I wouldn't be surprised if there are some riders that have heated grips on their bikes.
Probably.
I don't know. I doubt the top factory bikes are running heated grips just because the guys are pretty particular about minimalist
grip size
and they want a particular feel from
their
grips.
Plus they're popping grips on and off a lot, fresh grips every other day.
But I wouldn't be surprised if some of the more sportsman riders have a heated grip set up. I would.
Definitely.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. If you haven't ridden with heated grips, you're missing out.
And generally also at the start of the special every day, usually the organization provides a bag.
Yeah. Like a laundry bag.
Stuff your stuff in, and then they transport it back to the bivouac. So you'll have it that night.
Or at the start of the liaison back to the bivouac if it's going to be later in the afternoon and cold again, maybe.
Yeah, normally they won't take it to the finish of the stage. So a lot of times guys will stuff a little windbreaker or something in the back of their rally jacket.
Back of their jacket. So they have something
to wear on the way back after the stage.
Yeah.
Cool. But the mornings are usually the worst ones. It's usually the coldest in the morning.
Yeah, you can see them bundled up. So yeah, they have a whole over set of gear. And they should be wearing Climb if they want to stay really warm. That'd be
a smart thing to do.
That's my advice. Last one here for Quinn, because he has inside information. Who's riding the new KTM this year? And is it split up in the factory teams like it was in Morocco? We know some guys were riding old bike in Morocco. Some guys were riding new bike in Morocco. Who's riding the new KTM this year at Dakar?
So kind of two parts of this. First, in Morocco, it was the final round of the World Championship Series. So the riders who were in contention for the World Championship rode the old bike because that was what they were more comfortable on, and they didn't want to risk anything if they were in possible championship contention. So
the new bike was still being developed.
The new bike's still in development. Yeah. So they wanted to kind of use the Morocco rally as a test in a way, and have the other riders that were out of contention for the World Championship test the new bike and try some different stuff each day. Then they had the guys that are in contention, which was, I think, Matthias Wachner and I forget who the other guy was that was there, maybe Skyler or something, but anyway, ride the old bike. So now for Dakar, all the riders on factory KTM, Husqvarna and GasGas are on the new bike, except for Petrucci,
right,
who is on the old bike, basically just because of resources. It was a rush to get the new bike ready for the race, and Petrucci was kind of a last minute add, and they hadn't planned enough parts for the whole factory team
even had time for him to test, probably.
Right. Yeah. So that's
Petrucci's on the old bike. Everybody else is on the new one. Speaking of Petrucci, let's find out something about this guy. Let's talk to Rennie.
Yeah.
Rennie Skaysbuk, Cycle News road test editor. We're calling him right now. All right. This is Rennie Skaysbuk. He's a road test editor at Cycle News, and he's a hell of a sport bike rider. So maybe you can tell us who the hell this Danilo Petrucci guy is and why he's out there winning Dakar rally stages.
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't think any of us ever thought that he was going to be as good as he is. He was a hell of a rider. He was, in MotoGP, he's basically the last of, I guess you could say, the old school riders that have succeeded in MotoGP. You know, he wasn't a child prodigy or anything as far as winning mini bike championships or things like that. And he's a bigger dude as well. Like, I mean, I've stood next to him in the pits and, he's sort of 170 odd pounds or so. And when everyone else is 120 dripping wet.
Yeah.
and he's about 6 foot or so tall. So, you know, when you put him against guys like Jorge Martin and Danny Pedrosa, and that he looks like he's literally twice their size. And,
yeah.
So he was always physically, you know, I guess hampered in MotoGP. He was always such a tenacious dude. I mean, anybody who's ever watched the 2019 Italian MotoGP, and for me, that's probably the most, I guess you could say heartwarming, but it's like, I mean, talk about an intense race. Like, the dude won his home Grand Prix. It's kind of like, you know, that great story of the guy who just keeps, you know, plugging away and gets a little bit here, a little bit there, and he wins the biggest race of his life, an Italian bike in Mugello in front of 100,000 fans. It's one of the sport's great moments. So,
awesome.
But I don't think he was ever going to really make it as a world champion in MotoGP. It was always kind of against him in that regard. And his move to KTM last year really didn't work for him. He was put in the B team, which also has factory equipment, but, you know, B team is a B team. And unfortunately, he got kind of moved aside for the new young guns in Remy Gardner and Raul Fernandez. He's always been a very good dirt bike rider. He's always been mates with Andrea Dovizioso, who's an exceptionally good rider off-road. And so for him to then get the opportunity to do the Dakar, because he had spoken about it for a number of years and saying, oh, I'd like to have a crack, I'd like to have a go. And, our own Cycle News, our own Gene Turner has witnessed firsthand, because Danilo would come out to Southern California every year or so, basically before the pandemic, and go right at Cahir and Glen Helen and all that. And the guy's a beast on a dirt bike. And she was like, yeah, this guy's a real deal. And sure enough, yeah, he gets on this thing. I mean, but that's the thing. Like, you can ride, there's a lot of guys that can ride a dirt bike. It's also the navigation side of things. There's so many elements that go into being a good Dakar rider. And it just seems to click for him. And unlike in MotoGP, you know, he is the right size. He's a big dude. He's a very physically strong guy. Very intelligent. Hasn't bashed himself up too much in MotoGP, which is always a bit of a rarity. So I really hope that he sticks with it, because Italy could really use a good strong Dakar rider. You know, Britain. Britain's with Sam Sunderland, and the Aussies have got Sanders and Perth, and, you know, we've got Brabeck and Skylar Howes and Mason Klein. And
it's been a while since the Italians have had anybody that's really been up there, you know, so.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, it would be, and it's great for the sport. I mean, like, my Instagram has just exploded watching memes of Petrucci, and like the road bike guys have just got on this like you wouldn't believe. And for him to go out and win a stage, it's pretty amazing for any rookie alone, let alone, but I mean, the guy is a MotoGP race winner, let's not forget, so the guy knows what he's doing behind the handlebars.
I know there was a little bit of drama around the time he was kind of cut from the KTM team, and, you know, when they brought in Remy Gardner, do you know a little bit about that, about how that all went down and how he ended up with this Dakar ride?
Yeah, it was a strange situation. I mean, KTM and Red Bull have, like they have almost in Formula One, you know, they've got the Red Bull Junior Driver Program, and I guess you could say they've got the equivalent in two wheels as well. And Remy Gardner, and especially Raul Fernandez. I mean, Gardner's only been in the Red Bull KTM IO team, which is the Moto2 team. He's only been in it for one year, but Raul Fernandez has been there from day dot, you know, since he was a junior. And so the Tech 3 team has always been, which is what Petrucci was riding for last year, and is also his entry in the Dakar. And the Tech 3 team was always seen as the junior team. Oliveira came through there, and his teammate last year was Ike Lekuona, who was a 21-year-old Spanish prodigy from Valencia. So he was always the elder statesman in the junior team, which was a little bit of an odd situation. And
yeah, you're on.
I
that.
Mean, he had
on the edge.
He had been in. Yeah, exactly. Like, he'd been in the game now since 20. 2012, I think it was, 2013, 2012, and worked his way through the, you know, the bottom rung teams. Like, he was on the slowest bike of the grid by a mile when he turned up to MotoGP. Now, he was something like 25, 30 mile an hour, sometimes slower down the straight, which is just light years in MotoGP.
Yeah,
may as well take a school bus. But, you know, he worked his way up to the second-tier Ducati team and the Pramac team, and then into the factory Ducati team. And then he unfortunately got the boot for Jack Miller and went to the junior KTM team. And with Pit Beirer obviously being the man as far as everything goes with racing in KTM, he knew that he had, and everyone loved the guy. That's, this is a big big thing as well. You know, he's the big friendly giant of MotoGP, and you never ever see the guy without a smile on his face. And he's got such a great attitude. Like, I remember in the San Marino Grand Prix, which was the last time he was to race in front of his hometown, in front of his home crowd. He got punted at the first corner by the world champion, Joan Mir. And he was like, yeah, whatever, and kept smiling on his face. And that stuff really wears off on guys like, you know, Byra and, yeah, you know, the head. Yeah. So, like, he's got the good graces of KTM really a lot. So, yeah, with, I guess, you know, KTM's got a lot of pull in a lot of areas of motorcycling. So, sure enough, yeah, he got the gig. And I don't know, I'm not privy to the absolute details of the whole thing. Like, I would assume, especially now, given the fact that he's shown that he can do the job, that this is going to become a regular thing for him. And but, I mean, there's also talk that he's coming to Moto America this year to race for the HSBK team to replace Loris Baz. Don't really know how he's going to be able to do a factory Ducati contract and a factory KTM contract in the same year, but it's kind of interesting.
Right. Well, it would be interesting, A, to see him continue in rally, but also B, to have KTM have sort of a second official team at the race in a Tech 3 sort of outfit. You know, they've dropped this bike out there with the Tech 3 graphics and the whole, you know, thing, and it fits, it works, it got a stage win. Like, I know inside KTM they race, and when they win a race, they a little light bulb goes off and they're like, hey, there's something here, we should keep doing this, we should keep winning.
Yeah, we race.
Absolutely.
we race yeah. and when we succeed at racing, that's the number one goal, because we're going to learn a lot from it. And yeah, this worked.
I mean, he was really set up ideally,
yeah,
for the situation, right? He came in as a rookie,
yeah,
on a factory team, which,
yeah,
doesn't happen generally.
Right. Right.
So,
yeah.
And then, you know, he was set up pretty ideally for his stage win, you know, starting position and everything else. And, you know, Toby Price's his errors and things,
yeah,
like that.
Time,
so,
penalty all comes,
I mean,
down
it was
to
a
it.
Perfect storm for him to get that win. And, yeah, and it was massive for the sport.
Yeah.
In a way.
Sure.
So,
yeah,
you know, really cool to see. Mm-hmm. I don't know how old he is, or, you know, what his future would look like.
He's 31.
31. Yeah. So, I mean, when KTM goes to invest in a future factory star, right, they're looking to invest in young guys to bring along, you know.
Yeah,
I mean,
true.
I think he's good for the sport.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I don't know that the future is going to be, you know, Daniello racing rally being the guy that goes and wins Dakar for KTM.
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
I understand that. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah,
that would be a.
It is a hard thing, because, you know, like everything, once you get past 30 in racing, you're seen as over the hill. But
yeah,
I tend to think especially in road racing, we've seen longer careers than were previously. So, I mean, you could take Valentino Rossi out of the equation, because that guy's just a freak. But
yeah.
But, you know, you're starting to see guys running into their mid-30s and still being competitive. But,
right,
but it is I guess it is pretty hard for them to completely switch disciplines at over 30. And I guess you could definitely be competitive, but it's more the fact of trying to convince the bosses that, yeah, you're competitive. Because,
yeah, for sure.
There was another guy, a MotoGP rider called Jürgen van der Gorberg, who... He raced a number of Dakars, but he was always in the Malimoto class.
Mm-hmm.
I think he might have won it one year.
Yeah, I think he did. He was a Dutch guy. I was actually, my first Dakar, I was on a team with Jürgen, and So I got to know him pretty well, and he's a super good guy and cool. Super Dakar enthusiast.
You have to be.
Yeah, big time. Big time, yeah. I mean, he's a legend as far as Dutch motorsport goes. Like, he raced for Kenny Roberts and for a number of huge teams. Like, he was in the era of the end of the 500s, the start of the four-stroke era in MotoGP. And he never got a win in MotoGP. I think he might have got the odd podium, but yeah, like a proper legend of the sport. And his son is now racing in Moto2 in the World Championship. So it's great to see that there is. I always love it when a guy that's good turns into something else and is also good at that, because it proves that it's not just a one-line thing.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, MotoGP riders or road racers in general, you know, we all love, I'm not a MotoGP racer. I just love, I'm just like riding sports bikes. But like, you know, we all ride dirt bikes. And it's good to see that. I mean, I've seen Dovizioso ride a dirt bike, and like, I mean, that guy is Grand Prix level fast. Like, he is an animal on a dirt bike. And you know, you see other dudes like Valentino was always a really, really good rider. Mark Marquez on a dirt bike. Yeah. There's footage of him riding at the Spanish Grand Prix circuit. I think it was Mantova or whichever the track is that they hold the Spanish MXGP at. And the dude is absolutely shredding it on a motocross bike. Like, it's
not uncommon. I mean, Jake Gagne
is a perfect example.
Yeah, he qualified for an outdoor national.
Yeah.
pretty well. And you watch him ride on a track here, local in Southern California tracks. You're like, who's this new factory Yamaha? Oh, it's Jake Gagne. Oh, he wears leather suits when he races sport bikes, and look at him go. Not uncommon. Yeah. To deflect from your sport bike, you know, heritage, what is up with the Australians in Dakar? Like, you guys are crushing it again. You, Australian, obviously, but also you're a Dakar nerd. Like, this is the time of year where there's not a lot of road racing. There's not a lot of road bike testing to go on because everybody's kind of in between test bikes and we're, you know, just getting fired up for the year. So you're like fully invested in Dakar. What's it like being an Australian and like seeing the Australians crush it all the time?
Well, it's
national,
quite funny
national
because,
pride.
Yeah, oh, totally. You know, kangaroos all the way.
Kangaroos.
It's funny too because like when Toby, I mean the Dakar, I remember back in the day when not Lyndon Heffernan. I feel really bad here. I forget the guy's name. It was an Aussie bloke that was killed in the Dakar in 2005.
Andy Caldicott?
Andy Caldicott, that's the one. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I was a mechanic back then. This is back in a previous life. And my a friend of mine and I, we would sit and listen to the radio announcements of the Dakar. I mean, this is back when the Dakar was still solely in Africa.
Ah, cool.
You know, they were riding 990 KTM, things like that. I mean, I was early 20s back then, and that was my first real introduction to Dakar, because you know, obviously, like everybody, you know, pre YouTube, pre social media and all that stuff, like you only ever got, if you're lucky, you might have got a VHS tape at the end of the year, I remember having a big poster of Caldicott on my wall because I think he finished third one year, and on that big tank of a KTM, and you know, it was a big shot of him running across the Sahara, so I got super invested, and a lot of guys did, and that was big news in Australia when Andy was killed. Like, it kind of put Dakar on the map for the wrong reasons, but when he finished third the first year, I think 2015, I think it was, that became big news across the country, and when he won, like, he got legitimately famous. Like, you know, like sort of people knew, like ordinary people on the street knew who Toby Price was, because you know, being we are a island nation at the bottom of the world, and like when someone goes out and smashes it, it's like Chad Reed. When Chad Reed started kicking everyone's ass out here, he became legit famous as well, and so it was a big thing. And so the collective sort of national consciousness kind of focused a lot on Dakar, and it started to give other Aussie riders a bit of a shot as well. Daniel Sanders. I'm not too familiar with Sanders. Like, I haven't seen the guy race a lot. I mean, I've seen Toby race tons in Australia, like been out and watched him racing enduros and just exploding the dirt behind him and just wasting everybody. Like, I mean, Toby was on such another level back then.
I can tell you that Daniel Sanders is exactly the same.
I kind of figured as much. Like,
he's just the second coming of Toby Price in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
He's just fast, skilled, rad.
Yeah. You got to have a bit of sketchiness, I think, about you to be a proper Dakar racer, I think.
And, you call it sketchiness. I call it Australian.
In a good way. Yeah, completely. I mean, Toby's done such huge things for the sport, and it really elevated also the Think Desert Race in Australia. Like, that became that was always one of the gnarliest. Like, I've ridden the Think Desert track on a CRF 450, and I'm like, the hell with this, but at the same, that thing is gnarly, and I mean, it's only 500 Ks. It's kind of like our version of the Baja 1000, I guess, in a way. But I mean, there's a great film to watch called There and Back, which if you've watched that, gives you an idea of what it's all like. And it doesn't have a real happy ending, unfortunately, that film. But it did shine a light on some of the really good guys. There's a lot of guys that really could have a good go at it in Dakar. I mean, I think back a couple of years, Ty Simmons was Toby's teammate, and he's got out of the game now, but he was a guy that could have had another go. And it's just one of those things, you know, we've got a lot of wide open spaces, especially if you go out into the real desert, into the outback, it's flat out.
Australia is made for it.
Yeah, I raced the Australasian Safari in Western Australia
there you go.
A few years ago, and I think it was last year they had it, actually. I think 2014. And it was, I mean, you never let off the gas for
so big.
7 days.
Big and it open.
Yeah.
Wide open, and the guys go so fast in that stuff. And there's kangaroos jumping out in front of you. And so just like getting comfortable with the fact that there's emus and kangaroos and
the speed.
Stuff wanting to kill you, and you're going 170 kilometers an hour next to a fence line, next to a barbed wire fence for 3 hours at a time.
It makes sense why they're coming over to Dakar Rally Racing and really hitting it. I mean, the national pride of Australia is alive and well in this race, and for great reason. So outside of your obvious Australian favorites, you've been following the race this year. Who's your prediction to really come up in the second half of this race and, you know, really shine at the end?
I got to say, like, I've been bloody impressed. I mean, it's obviously, that's an easy thing to say, but I've been extremely impressed with Sam Sunderland. Like, he's obviously being the leader of the rally, but he's really playing a long game. He's not sticking his neck out too hard. Had a crash a couple of days ago, which he sounds like he was pretty lucky to get out of. I would love to see Chucky, you know, get up there and get a win in Daniel, but I've got to say, my personal favorite, and I would love to see it happen, although I just can't see it anymore, I'd love to see Joan Barreda get the win, just because a guy that's had that many stage wins in terms of race win.
It would be nice to see him put it all together.
Yeah. I mean, I got to hang out with him a bit when I did the Vegas to Reno with Johnny Campbell. He was a really good guy, a really good dude, and we had a good time. And I think in terms of, it's pretty hard to look past Sanders. Adrian Van Beveren was another one that's been, you know, quietly kind of chipping away. I think outside of Sanders, Van Beveren, Sunderland, obviously, the under guys just doesn't look like they've got it this year. Pablo Quintanilla is the lead under rider, and Ricky's a mile back. And unfortunately, after what happened, I think it was day two, it all went to pieces for him. So, and Skylar Howell's obviously being out, and obviously got a big soft spot being here in the States for the American boys. And I think Sunderland's got to be the favorite, and now he's going to have to go into, I don't think he's going to go in conservation mode just yet. He's still got, it's only a 2 minute odd lead that he has. So it's, you know, that you can lose that very, very quickly. But it's only ever been, you know, a good 2 or 3 minutes for the first six or seven stages of the rally, and he's managed to keep that advantage the whole time. So I can't imagine he's going to blow it too hard at this stage. If he does, it's going to be navigational areas. I don't think he's going to throw it down the road. If anything, it'll be navigational problems. But as we've seen with, you know, Toby and Ricky and, you know, Sanders and everyone, they've all suffered it. Whereas Sunderland seems to be the only guy who's kind of kept it all together so far. But, you know, we're only halfway there.
Yeah, long race to go. Well, thanks, man. I really appreciate you giving us the insight into, you know, Petrucci and the MotoGP angle. It's fun hearing your insight to that, because we're just watching this guy going, whoa, where'd he come from? Yeah. And now we know where he came from.
Well, I mean, super for the cool American fans out here, we'll, looks like we'll get to see a lot more of him this year, and he'll be in red riding the HSBK bike as far as I'm aware. So yeah, no official announcement's been made yet, but I think it's all a done deal. It's a very big coup for Moto America to get a, you know, up until 2020, he was still winning MotoGP races. Wow. So yeah, it's a pretty big deal for Moto America to get that guy on the grid.
Wow, very cool. We'll be looking forward to that. Cycle news. Thanks again, Rennie. Rennie Skaysbrook.
Right, you got it.
You're the thanks, man. Guys. Cheers.
Yeah.
Thanks, Rennie.
All right, yeah, very cool, dude. Here's Rennie's perspective on things, and, you know, learn a little bit more about Petrucci, because he's kind of a little bit of a mystery to us off-road guys anyway.
Yeah, for sure. Off-road guys, we're simple, closed-minded dirt bikers.
Right. Andrew, you know, I've started following MotoGP in the last couple of years, especially since KTM's gotten involved, and it's quite a sport. And these guys are pretty incredible athletes, and it's
it's really
amazing.
Cool.
And clearly their talent crosses over.
Yeah, what an awesome performance. Another great performance this year that we teased everybody about, maybe get some inside information on, is the Hero Motorsports team. A Speed Brain runs the outfit. The old Speed Brain was an old Husqvarna factory racing when BMW owned Husqvarna. You actually had a contract to race for them, and then Husqvarna got bought out by the KTM group, and all those racing things kind of evaporated. But Speed Brain lived on, developing that race bike into the Speed Brain team, and then Hero ends up acquiring that sort of entity, turns into the Hero race team. But they got a stage win this year. Joaquim Rodriguez came in, got a stage win. Really cool. And you still know Wolfie. And you wanted to maybe get him on the phone today, give him a little insight into the Hero program.
Yeah, so Wolfgang Fischer, he's a buddy of mine that I've known for quite a few years. And like you said, I rode for him for a brief period of time. So yeah, we're going to try to give him a call right now and see if we can get a little insight into the Hero team.
Hero.
Ready? Hey, Wolfie.
Hey, Quinn.
Hey, how are you?
I can hear you.
Hi, Wolfie.
Cool.
Good rally for you guys so far. Pretty incredible and kind of historic to get your first Hero Motorsports stage win this year. How does that feel after all these years?
Yeah, after all this, what we went through, it's really, really absolutely amazing and a historic moment. Yeah. Really, really nice.
For sure.
Did you expect a win this year coming in after, you know, all the work that's gone in the past year?
Well, now, this year we tried to be, to do as many rallies as possible to get the bike to let the last fine tuning and especially the riders get more cell time after last year, nothing, basically, with all the lockdowns.
Yeah, right.
And during the season, we could see already the bike is at the point. We got same top speeds as Hondas and KTMs. We did a few stage wins, basically each race more or less, where we went. Then a podium in Silkway and then a podium in Abu Dhabi. So we are quite confident that we can work out and we can race with the guys up front. But here, of course, at Dhaka, there are always a few guys more. So you have maybe 20 guys who are fit enough for a stage win.
Yeah.
Or for going in the top five. So it's always a special day when it's then clicking and working out. So
yeah,
it's great to get that.
Very cool. Yeah.
Sounds like a lot of work went in this year to make that happen. Not only development of the bike, but also attending all those races and the development of the bike. I think we got a lot of questions about the bike in particular, because it's not based on anything that we're that familiar with, especially here in the US. Can you give us any insight to what the new Hero bike is like compared to other bikes we might be more familiar with?
Well, the bike what we had before was more or less a evolution of what we had in speed train development, what you also know, speed train. And the engine was just getting outdated at the point. We could not get more power out of it, and we knew, okay, we need about 20% more to compete, to be competitive. And then about 2 years ago, a bit more, and the rule was changing so that the engine does not to be based on a production bike engine, and that gave us then basically hands free to make a complete rally proto engine. And this was the starting point. And we built our chassis around it and developed the engine, a conventional engine with all what we knew, what is durable, what gives us the power to be in rally, so we could really just focus on the pure rally engine, and that was the start point. And all the experience what we had from the chassis and suspensions, we could put in, and with a small team in Germany, we started with that project. And in 2019, then Hero, our partner Hero, is basically the race team for them, but as an external company, decided then to found at the same place in Germany at our workshop, Hero Development Center, Hero Tech Center Germany. And this was building up to manpower, actually over 50 guys working there from the handful where we have been a few years ago. And so we have a lot of synergies there, doing prototype development for India for serial bikes, and having there the race department. So that was, of course, a very good condition to focus on what we had as experience and what we wanted to build. And so in really quick time, and with our usual good suppliers around, good network, we could make it happen and made a really nice bike.
Wow, very cool. So that the engine was basically developed by your team there in Germany from zero then?
Basically, yeah, with Hero together in India, with the engineers there, with our engineers here, with all the possibilities what you have nowadays to make engines faster produced, basically, you know, that you can make 3D printing cylinder heads, CNC machines, cases, and stuff like that. And this is something, if you know what you want and you have the right guys, it's much faster done than in the past.
Wow,
very
cool.
Still sounds like a massive job to me. A big undertaking to develop an engine from scratch to compete at something as grueling and as gnarly as rally racing seems very daunting of a task to me.
It is. And we have been really happy that it was basically working well out. And we had the year in 2020 after our tragic accident with Paolo. We had a kind of needed a downtime for the team. We could not go just out for the next race, so we took all the focus and our motivation out of doing this development, and have been testing step by step all year then in Portugal, as we could not go to Morocco for testing, for example. And we had there a big private area, and Gerard is living there. So the team was spent a couple of months there testing and bringing the parts from Germany and building it up. And then last year, Dakar was basically Dakar was the first rollout of the bike in desert. We never have been in any desert conditions before.
Wow, from last year. Last year's Dakar Rally was the first time it hit the ground running.
Yeah.
Wow, amazing.
Exactly. What a development from hitting the ground running at Dakar last year for the first time to winning in the second year it's been racing.
Yes.
Very good.
That's a success story.
And so riders on the rest day, how I know J-Rod had a pretty good crash. day or so ago. How's he feeling now after a day of rest?
Well, he's quite okay. But he's a tough guy. He had actually had two crashes in a row at the second stage. A big front flip. He hit the ground on the back, but also what is really helpful for the riders to prevent serious injuries is now this new airbag system, what is compulsory. So we run this Alpine Stars airbags, and this was helping him for sure not getting more back pain. And we have a team physio who is really very fit and working with him every day and getting really in decent shape again. So yesterday's stage was quite good for him. And for tomorrow, I think it's like not like 100% new, but you know, when the adrenaline is in and his riding should be okay.
Yeah. Very good. Well, I appreciate you taking a few minutes to talk to us, Wolfie. I know you're busy there, and you know, we want to wish you the best of luck in the rest of the rally.
Yeah, thank you.
For sure.
Yeah, thanks. When we had our share of bad luck before the rally. Not to forget, we had two riders more at the grid and doing the rallies with us all year. With Sebastian Bühler, a young German guy living in Portugal, and Franco Caini from Argentina. They have been both injured in end of November, beginning of December in Abu Dhabi rally and then in training in Dubai. So these two dropped out, and then we got last minute replacement with Aaron Murray. He's also adapting very fast to the bike and doing really well here.
Yeah, so sounds like the program is
happy with that.
You got to be after, you know, losing some top competitors out of the team and still having a success. I think it shows that the bike just probably works really well, and the guys that you're picking up and the team around them is really, really coming together and working. Yeah, so congratulations again.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate that. Welcome.
Very good. Yeah. Good luck, and hopefully next time I'm in Europe, I can stop by for a beer.
For sure.
Yeah, it would be really nice. Always welcome. We have the good Bavarian beer for you.
For sure.
Thanks, Wolfgang.
All right. Thanks, Wolfie. Talk soon.
Yo.
Cheers.
Yo, take care. Thank you, guys. Bye.
Bye. Sweet.
All right.
See, I learn something every time we call these people. I didn't know that the Hero Motorsports team is based in Germany because of Speed Brain. Makes sense now. And so cool that the bike was developed in the last 2 years, like really fresh. All new motor, just built from the ground up, and there's 50 people working on that up there in Germany.
I mean, and that's not a simple thing to develop an engine from ground zero. You know, all the other teams in KTM is using an engine that's shared with the motocross platform.
Yep.
Yamaha is using an engine there. I mean, Honda Honda developed their own engine, but that was 7 years ago now. So they've been using the same engine for a long time.
So massive investment, massive commitment. Cool support by the Hero organization to, you know, create that. It sounds like a development center in Germany for motorsports with Wolfgang and the Speed Grain crew, and really cool, exciting stuff coming from them. I wonder if we see any production 450 rally replicas from Hero coming out of that
again. But yeah, it might be interesting. Maybe we see a rally replica Hero edition
that's clearly competitive.
Right.
Yeah. Super cool. Because really, the only manufacturer you can buy a rally bike and race is a KTM. You know, the factory rally replica bike. I mean, it is insane that you can buy that thing, honestly, in some aspects. But what a fantastic motorcycle.
They do a very, very limited production run of those, and those are competition only motorcycles. So they're a race bike, and you know, they're designed for rally racing purely. And it's really difficult to get your hands on one unless you are
in line
in the Dakar rally.
Yeah. Super cool that opportunity is out there. You see a few of them floating around. I actually got a chance to ride one with you, we had our grubby little hands on, and such a cool experience. Like, those bikes are next level awesome.
Yeah. They're awesome motorcycles for sure. And, you know, I was lucky enough to get to test, the new generation this summer. We spent a lot of time durability testing on that bike, and it's a cool experience to be involved in that.
Jealous. I'm going to ride one this year. All right. What else do we want to talk about today, Quinn?
Gosh, I think the only thing we really got talk about is kind of moving. Well, I mean, there's lots to talk about. We could go on for hours, but
yeah,
I think we got to take a look at stage seven.
Stage seven is going to be a massive day, 700 kilometers. If it holds to the plan,
let's hope it does.
Sand galore, it says underneath the route description. Oh boy. What is it going to be like, Quinn? And how am I going to take a pick?
Galore. I mean, it looks like, to me, it looks like it's going to be...
Uncharted territory, it actually says.
Yeah, it's going to be a long one. It's 404 kilometers, so, you know, you know that there's potential for some time to be made up, some time to be lost.
Talking about 100 kilometers of dunes.
Yeah, I feel like...
33% sand.
Daniel Sanders got a bit of a penalty by them shortening that stage.
Definitely.
So he's got to lead out into a 400 kilometer stage, and he didn't really get a lot of much of a time bonus to do that.
Yeah, he got the short end of that stick for sure, and yep. You can tell he's upset about it.
For sure.
So it's going to be a tough day for Sanders to, you know, maintain that time gain he got on stage six.
Yep. So
who's in a position to take advantage of this?
And then we'll kind of wrap things up.
All right. I don't know who I'm picking.
Really? You have no idea.
I don't know.
Okay.
It's too hard.
Is it a pick or a guess?
I'm going to try to guess.
Okay. If it's a guess, I'm going to say Toby Price.
That's a good guess. That's who I was looking at. I should have just said it first.
You can copy me.
Toby seems to be healthy, number one. He hasn't had any big crashes that we've heard of. And he should have won that stage, but he got a speeding ticket. I think Toby's the clear choice. The only other option I see is Adrian Van Beveren, who's right in front of him in eighth, just because he's been riding pretty well this year. Again, I don't think he's had any issues. And, I think he could maybe get a stage win for Yamaha if, you know, Ross Branch is out there helping him out. I don't know when Ross is going to start, though.
I mean, Ross is probably going to start in the back, I'd imagine. Yeah. So he might come swinging if he's feeling okay. He might rip through the pack.
Oh, that would be something if Ross came back and won the stage. But I would love to see it for him for sure. But
I'd love to see Ricky Brabec, see some action from him for sure. He's starting in fifth. So
he's in a spot. He could make potential. A big move.
He could definitely make a move, but.
Yep, it'd be good to see him get some swagger back for sure.
Yeah, start the second week strong.
All right, I think we're both picking Toby, though.
All right.
There you go. We're on the same team around here. Well, thanks, everybody, for listening. It's a long show today, but a lot to cover on the rest of the day, and we could try to put together something interesting and fun with a lot of different perspectives for everybody. But, hey, just keep hitting us up on Instagram at Dakar Rally Daily, all underscores between all that stuff. And we're going to be back here for the Climb Dakar Rally Daily Show bright and early in the morning Sunday.
On Sunday.
Sunday fun day.
No rest.
No rest for us. Nobody else gets a rest. Thanks to Rally Navigator for presenting the show today. Also, thanks to our friends at Double Take Mirror and Giant Loop for being on board. We're having a great time. Thank you.